You're very welcome back to The Late Debate. With me tonight, Independent TD Shane Ross, Patricia Quinn, who advises not-for-profit organisations on governance matters, Niall O'Connell is Managing Partner with Midpoint HR International, Alison O'Connor is columnist with The Irish Examiner, and Alan McDonnell is Founder and Director of Empira Corporate Governance Advisors. You're all very welcome indeed. It was a five-hour session which started badly and remained tetchy for most of the afternoon. Angela Cairns, Chief Executive of the Rehab Group, was before the Oireachtas Public Accounts Committee today to explain how much of her salary and those of other rehab executives were paid for by the taxpayer. It started badly because some of the people the committee wanted to question didn't show up, the chairman and the remuneration committee. And before that, rehab solicitors had written to the PAC telling them that they could not question Ms. Cairns about her salary. At today's hearing, Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald asked her to explain this letter.
I don't think there's anything wrong with our legal people seeking clarity on what was expected of us today, and that's all that was.
Well, Ms. Cairns, it in fact was not that. The communication from your legal representative was to set down a marker and what they regarded as the parameters of the discussion which you would deem appropriate for us to have at committee today.
And, Deputy, if you could explain to me what the problem would with that.
Well, the problem with that, Ms. Cairns, is that you are an agency in receipt of €83 million in the last year of public funding. The problem with it is that you very stubbornly and publicly maintain a position that because you have commercial interests, that really the general public, including volunteers and people who contribute to your organisation in charitable donations, are not to meddle or interfere or ask questions that you, in your collective wisdom, deem to be inappropriate or commercially sensitive. That's the problem, Ms. Cairns.
Well, then Deputy MacDonald challenged Angela Cairns over her pay of €240,000, being more than the Taoiseach's and the US President's. This was the rehab boss's response.
I'm a private citizen and I work for a private not-for-profit company and I'm not paid by the taxpayer. I've been asked my salary and I've been willing to waive my privacy rights to give that figure.
It's all of that, yeah.
I didn't have to do it, but I, as I say, volunteered to do it. I have given substantial total and conclusive information, and I've read all sorts of articles that talked about balloon payments and hidden bonuses and under-the-counter payments and a lot of speculation. There is nothing there. You have it in full.
Do you understand that it is very difficult to square the mission of your group, your reliance on the state, your reliance on voluntary effort and contributions with a salary, and it's just your basic salary, of €240,000 per annum? Or is that an alien concept to you? Are we operating on or in completely different planets?
Deputy, you said you thoroughly understood the rehab group, and that is good to hear. But in your commentary there, you forget that there is a significant other part of the rehab group, and there's a significant part of the rehab group that isn't in Ireland, and there's a significant part of the group that is commercial. And in addition to all of the very, very important work that Rehab Care and that NLN and that other organisations within the Rehab Group do, there is a very significant commercial organisation and the running of businesses in this organisation. And even if I mentioned one already for you today, is our recycling business. That is the largest recycling business in this country.
The Chief Executive of the Rehab Group, Angela Cairns, being questioned today at the Public Accounts Committee by Sinn Féin Deputy Mary Lou MacDonald. Shane Ross will join us when he's finished on prime time. Patricia Quinn, I'll come to you first. Was it right that Angela Cairns was before this committee today being asked about her salary?
Well, I suppose My view would be that the board is responsible for setting the remuneration package, for setting the goals and the strategies, the vision of the organisation, for recruiting and retaining a chief executive, and for setting the remuneration of that chief executive. They are the people who have set the rate, and in their view, that's the correct rate. I think that boards have been missing in this whole controversy.
And the Remuneration Committee, they were invited to today's hearing, but they didn't show up.
Well, as with many other charities who have found themselves being called to account, the function, the governance function to hold chief executives to account, I think, has been lost sight of.
Do you think, though, that the Remuneration Committee, the board, should have been at the PAC answering questions about salaries if, as Angela Kern says, she's not paid by the taxpayer?
I think that's a separate question. I think that the point that I would like to make is that the board sets remuneration. I find it invidious that chief executives have been so much the people in the front line being asked to explain their remuneration when they don't set it. These are not social enterprises or private companies that have been established by the founder, who is the chief executive. They've been established by other people. Mm-hmm. And the boards are responsible for setting the price of the job. It is a point that Angela Kearns tried to make in a previous interview, that, and I think she was criticised for avoiding the question about the level of her own remuneration. But I do think there is a more general question about the size and the price of these jobs, because there is now a market in these services. And I think that's a wider issue that I hope that we will move on to.
Yeah, we absolutely will discuss that later. But I suppose what I'm trying to get at is, do you think that the board of rehab in particular is accountable to the PAC?
I think every board involved in the non-profit sector is accountable to the public. There are stakeholders in the work of all of these organisations, because they have set themselves up as organisations delivering social or public goods of various kinds. So there is a wider accountability, and the Public Accounts Committee or public representatives more generally are citing that. But I think that the general question of transparency, as distinct from accountability, which is the Public Accounts Committee is there to talk about accountability, but I think that in the accountability structures that have been created around public funding, we have lost sight, perhaps, of the wider need for public transparency in relation to all of these questions, and not just remuneration.
I'm just curious to ask Patricia, or just following your line of thought there, saying that it's the board that set it and the price for the job. But yet it's the chief executive, in this case, Angela Kearns, who accepts it, you know, who accepts the money every month, who is the head of this organisation, who takes the responsibility. So I would take your point that the board has set the salary, but I don't see how you would hide behind the skirts of the board, if you like, when asked, for instance, on a Morning Ireland interview, or in front of the Public Accounts Committee, what is your salary?
Yes, I'm not commenting on whether or not she ought to have answered the question. I do think the question is more correctly posed to the people who set the price for the job, because they took the decision. They made the choice. They went to the market and looked for somebody because that was what they thought it was worth.
I suppose that I think what that touches on is the more general point that we have seen with the CRC, even in relation to the St. Vincent's Hospital Group, the thing that is quite stunning that has survived the recession, is this attitude of, you know, I'm worth it, they're worth it, we'll give you that, I'll accept that, hundreds of thousands. And it's extraordinary. I mean, I wrote a column a few weeks ago saying, you know, give me a bit of that action. You end up, you know, at the end of the worst recession, you know, in living memory, thinking, where did I go wrong? You know,
how did I miss out on that?
How did I miss out? How did I not set myself up as a consultant?
Alan McDonald, Alan, what did you make of her, Angela Kearns, responses or perhaps lack of detail when asked about her salary? She absolutely just didn't go there, didn't give any further detail on that. Was that right from her point of view, if she's adamant she's not paid by the taxpayer?
Well, I don't want to comment too much on one individual or one organisation. I'd like to discuss the issues in more general terms. But to do justice to your question, I feel there was too much focus on the salary issue today, over 5 hours of interrogation, when there were lots of other governance issues that are of wide public concern at the moment, not just with rehab, but with many organisations that we've heard of recently. And I would agree with Patricia's earlier comment. I think the governing bodies of these organisations have a lot to be held to account for. And where we talk about hiding behind the skirts of the board, I think the board in many organisations up to now have been hiding behind the skirts of the chief executive. I would like to see a lot more chairmen and board members being held to account in these matters, because public confidence is eroding so fast and they are the governing body.
But do you think that in terms of her salary, I know you say that perhaps there has been too much emphasis on it, but as far as the public is concerned, given the revelations from the CRC, and I know they're a different type of organisation, but after today's hearing, the public still doesn't know if their money, if their donations in any way contribute to her salary or to the salary of other executives at rehab.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions there, certainly. And an organisation like Rehab, which is part charity, part commercial, and then there's this group holding, pulling it all together, where different revenue sources end up, is very confusing. And this really demands two words come to mind: accountability and transparency. And I think one of the problems we witnessed today is we're not seeing enough of both of those.
Patricia, just you wanted
in
there.
On a technical point, and I unfortunately didn't hear any of the debate during the day, but I did hear Angela Kern saying Rehab is a private company. And as a matter of fact, that's not true. Rehab is a company that's considered to be public under the Companies Act because it's a company limited by guarantee. It is not a shareholding company. And any company which is limited by guarantee, it means that there is no limit on the number of their members. And that's the reason that, however small, non-profit companies may not claim the exemption from filing full audited financial statements with the company's office. So we are entitled to know everything that a company limited by guarantee tells its members. That must also be put in the public domain.
And next question, does that apply to Rehab?
It applies to every company limited by guarantee, including Rehab. And then the next question is, well, what do the accounts of Rehab tell us? And of course, Rehab is a large and complex group, as Ms. Kern said. But unfortunately, Rehab, like almost every other charity in Ireland, uses a standard of financial reporting which is more readily adapted to commercial organisations than to charities. So the kind of information that you go looking for in a set of charity accounts, in all but a very small number of cases, you simply don't find them.
And we'll discuss the complicated nature of Rehab, or whether it's complicated or not, or maybe it's just being made to sound complicated in a few minutes. I should say at this point that we did issue an invitation to Rehab Director Frank Flannery, but we didn't get a response to take part in tonight's programme. Niall O'Connell. Niall, you're welcome. You're managing partner with Midpoint HR International. Just staying with Angela Kern's salary for the moment, because that's where the emphasis was on largely today. She said that she was paid 20% below the market median. What market are we talking about?
Well, I suppose, first of all, from a professional HR perspective, I think there's two sides to the argument here. I think there's the not-for-profit sector and there's the private sector. If I could flash through the private sector very quickly, which would be because, you know, you scope out your job spec, you go to the market, you pay the rate, you get your candidate, you have the process in place. I think, to be fair, there's ambiguity around the status of this, which is, you know, from a HR point of view, we are dealing with a not-for-profit company. OK, that's the first clarity point from my perspective. Second of all, when public money comes into play, other factors automatically come into play. So, you know, from it's not a logical argument to say, you know, whether the salary is too low or too high. I think what we have to focus on really is, you know, the fundamental questions aren't being answered here, okay, in general. Okay, and I think we're no wiser after the event today than we were before the event. Okay, but I think in the spirit of transparency, you know, I think there has to be clarity around two key issues for me. The first issue is around, you know, they get 83 million euros a year from the government, okay? And ultimately, you know, the question should be asked, will you clarify the status of your salary, right? Because to come out and say that commercially it's paid out of the commercial side of the organisation, there's left a void there. And unfortunately, that void is hurting every other charity, okay? Because at the moment, you know, if you look at different organisations, and we've done a lot of work in the not-for-profit sector in hiring executives, and I can remember one particular process where we went right to the wire with a CEO, and because we couldn't bridge the 30,000 gap that that person was looking for, we went to the option two that was on that selection list.
I just think people, when we say not-for-profit, people have a very definite view of what a not-for-profit organisation is, and they hear salaries of 240,000 and they think that is exorbitant.
Yep, but I suppose typically in your not-for-profit organisation, you know, the professional people that go into that sector of the economy, you know, they're typically following a particular mission or objective, or they feel they want to add value or give something back. Okay, that is the perception there anyway. Okay.
But I suppose that's the perception that people have
that
of
people
not-for-profits.
Yes.
But the reality is very
different.
But
the reality is that, you know, you try to run a not-for-profit organisation along the same ethos as a private-run organisation. Okay? But I think there's ambiguity around, first, the structure of this company, second of all, what it stands for, and third of all, you know, the fundamental questions are not answered.
So what's the benefit of a not-for-profit organisation? Is it...
Well, obviously there's charitable status, you know, from
a tax
point of view.
Is that purely it?
Well, no, but also I think, it, you know, don't forget there's a lot of volunteerism involved in this sector as well. Okay, so not alone the funds and the collection that goes on, but a lot of people work in this sector and they give back their skills back to certain companies because they want to give something back. So it's all but a corporate entity, but it's not in another way. Hmm. And I think that's the confusion. I think that's that people are confused.
Okay, but Shane Ross has joined us now. Shane, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Late Debate. We were just talking there about Angela Kern's salary and her lack of willingness to disclose much to you, if anything, today. We didn't learn anything today, did we?
No.
Was it a waste of time?
Nothing. It was an extraordinary experience. And just stop me when I tell you about it, because it went on for 7 hours, so I want to be brief. It was an amazing experience, because it started with last night when we got a communication from the solicitor, which you may know about, and to our solicitor, to our lawyer there, saying basically that they were going to come in and all they were going to talk about was three issues, which was a fairly defensive move, to say the least, to get something in communication from a lawyer to start with. They then came in, and Angela Cairns came in, who we'd asked in, and we'd asked in the Remuneration Committee, which is, I think, four people, but I'm not sure, the former chief executive, Frank Flannery, and Angela Cairns. Angela Cairns came in. She came in with three people we didn't ask in, which is unprecedented for the PAC. And they were the kind of chief executives of various groups. And then Mary Lou McDonald and John McGuinness asked her a few questions. And they charged straight into the point, which they said they wouldn't talk about, of course, because that's what politicians tend to do, and asked about her salary, etc. And she just blanked them, basically said she wasn't going to help on this issue at all. And she stonewalled all day on that particular issue. There was virtually nothing given. She did say that she might make available to us a thing called the Towers-Watson report, which is the basis on which she justifies her salary. There was just one thing we got. And that might be a bit of a breakthrough. And that was, at one stage in the evening, the senior executives who were there, I was looking for their salaries as well, because she'd said, look, I'm going to do some sort of revelations. I'm going to be a bit more open towards the end of the year, and we're going to try and find a formula for releasing, maybe in bands, what people have paid at the top. And my senior executives are behind me in that. And we'd ask them then, okay, the senior executives, if they were behind them, would they reveal the salaries? Would they tell us? And they said no. They were behind it, but they would say no, they wouldn't disclose. So, but the HSE were there, and they've got them. They've got the information. And
including
they said,
Angela Cairns?
Sorry, no. This is the second point I was going to make. And they said, I asked them, I said, will you give us them? And they said, well, actually, I'm obliged to under the Act. This is what the head of the HSE, Mr. O'Brien, said. I have to give them to you if you ask for them to a Ructus committee. So he's now given them to the clerk. The clerk has got all the senior, as far as I know, I haven't seen them, all the salaries of the senior executives. And then when I asked him, did that include Angela Cairns? I really thought we had a breakthrough here. He said no, because for some reason she's employed by a company which hasn't got the same relationship with the HSE.
But she doesn't know her salary.
Yeah, but we want to know how it got there.
Right.
We want to know.
You mean from which the funds, from whence it came?
No. I mean, the mystery about her salary is it went up from 234 to 240 in 2 years. And we don't even know whether that was a rise or it came down. We don't know when it came down or what that was the result of.
What do you think is, having sat there and listened to it, and I listened to it, I watched a lot of it in the afternoon, it was very depressing, really.
Yeah.
What do you think is the rehab game plan?
I think they've had it far too comfortable. I don't think they've got a game plan except to try and ride it out and be silent. And I think they've had it.
But that's surely utterly unrealistic at this point.
But people in positions like that live in that sort of cocoon, don't they? I think they've had it far too soft for too long. That salary, to my mind, is completely unjustifiable for an Irish charity. And I think they probably believe that themselves and can't believe their luck. And now they've discovered that they are, you know, they've found a means of justifying it by producing various reports, which I could rubbish, but I'm not going to now because I haven't got time. But various reports which say, okay, in the sector you get this sort of amount, and they're going to try and ride it out. And, you know, I hope they're not allowed to do so. I hope when the regulator comes in, he makes it far more transparent. And I hope that no charity in an economy like that allows, and no business, in fact, but a publicly funded one in the way that this is, allows its management to be paid so much at a time when other people are suffering so much. That's what's so offensive about it. And then being wanting to hide it for so long as well.
I think there's another point here. The not-for-profit sector, you know, if you take the CEO of Goal, I researched today the top 10 charities, not-for-profit charities, and I see that Goal, the CEO of Goal, Mary Andrews, is paid 95,000 a year, okay? And then at the top of the list, you have 240,000, okay? So I don't have any problem with that, but I think there is a balance to the argument as well here, which goes like this. The people who set the salaries should be inside in the PSC. Because to be fair, you know, Angela, like the CEO of Rehab could argue to Shane and his colleagues in the PSC, well, I was hired to do this job. I was hired based on pre-selection criteria, pre-evaluation matrix, was I competent for the role or not? It was obviously benchmarked. And, you know, there is an argument from a HR hat to say, well, let's get the people in who made that decision.
We asked them.
Okay, I think, to be fair, you know, you need to balance the argument as well and get in that remuneration board because ultimately, you know, under employment law, offer and acceptance, okay, she applied for the job and she got the job based on the structure that was in place.
Yes, but that goes back to the point Patricia was making earlier about corporate governance. But if we even go back to what we saw with the CRC and the back and forwards there in terms of jobs being given out and people selected, I mean, the entire process, right from the very beginning, would obviously need review.
Yeah, but I'm sure if Rehab had this all over again, I'm sure they would have approached this differently. Okay, they're in the middle of a storm here, but I think the 50% of the argument today is missing the people who set the standard.
Just on that point, I'd like to follow up on Niall. He mentioned Barry Andrews' salary, and I think, you know, it's not all black here. And unfortunately, what's happened in the healthcare sector has given people the impression, wrongly, quite wrongly, that the same is true across the entire charity sector, and it isn't. And there has been leadership within public policy makers. For example, in the international aid sector, it's no accident that some of the best financial reporting of any charities is to be found among international development aid charities. And one of the reasons for that is that Irish Aid has, for a number of years, made an absolutely explicit policy of public education in development aid issues. They have said, you're not just required to be accountable to us, you must also be transparent to the general public, because it's very important that the public sees that the money we give to you is doing things that are important for all of us. And I think that's just closing a loop which connects accountability with transparency in a way that means that, you know, you have much more trust and confidence, and I think that figures bear this out, in the international development aid sector than in other sectors. And leading charities like Concern, like Trocra, like Goal, like Goethe, have been for many years adopting this higher standard of accounting, financial accounting and reporting.
And Alan, when boards are deciding on their chief executive's pay in an organisation like Rehab, a not-for-profit organisation that we're told that it is, how do they decide on that salary? What do they take into account and how do they agree it?
Well, I would imagine that varies greatly from organisation to organisation. Like we just heard a few moments ago, when you look at chief executives of large non-profit organisations, the range is huge, from 100,000 up to 240,000, 250,000.
And down.
and down, absolutely. And I think what I find, there's another word that's important to me in this whole debate about governance within the non-profit sector, and the word is stewardship. And stewardship is a third party monitoring the quality of governance conducted by the boards of these organisations. And in the charity sector, it's the funders who are using public taxpayers' funds, which they're giving to these organisations. They should be acting as the stewards.
Mm. And how would they do that?
Well, by insisting on particular codes of governance and principles of governance that the organisations should adopt, and auditing the quality of the application of those standards of governance. There is, for example, in the charity sector, the code of governance for the community, voluntary and charitable organisations in the country. Now, of the 8,000 registered charities in Ireland, registered with the Revenue Commissioners, I think only about 200 of them have actually adopted that code mm-hmm. after 2 years. And that is not good. I think the whole sector itself needs to be seen to be a lot more committed to standards of good governance. And within the board itself, the key person who's going to be instrumental in influencing that is the chairman. And if the chairman does not get it, if the chairman does not understand that his board, sitting around the boardroom table, needs to employ best practice and governance standards, that organisation is going to have problems.
Shane Ross, is it time to rethink the charitable status afforded to a group like Rehab? Because clearly, given what she said today, people are asking, how is this a charity?
Well, that's right. I mean, they're wearing two hats at the same time. When it's convenient, and playing ducks and drakes with various companies as well. And what they, you know, they get charitable status, and yet they say, you know, as they're a commercial, as 60% of their business is done commercially, they're entitled to some sort of commercial secrecy. And that's quite clever and quite convenient. But if you take away their charitable status, of course, it may have awful complications and implications for the people who benefit from it. I mean, we tended to forget today, or I certainly did, and it's my fault. I mean, you tend to forget today the fantastic work they do. Hmm. And that's something which we mustn't forget, and we mustn't destroy that or harm that in any way in what we're doing. And there's no doubt that their funding will go down as a result of what's been happening. I think it's important that the kind of shock to the charity industry and the shock to Rehab and to the CRC, which are all basically wonderful organisations, is short and sharp. What we're fighting for is a transparency which will have a long-term good, and there may be a short-term harm. So I don't think really I would withdraw the charitable status because of the good work they do, but I would certainly keep pushing on for transparency. And it's quite apparent from what we saw today that we'll have to do something further to increase that transparency. There was an absolute militant opposition and obstruction of further transparency. And basically what they were saying to us was, we don't have to tell you, so we're not going to tell you, and we're not going to tell anybody else. That really isn't acceptable, so we'll have to push it further.
Presumably it's if the government didn't give Rehab yeah. €83 million, yeah. would her salary be a lot less?
Well, she would probably say no. But I would probably say yes, because the companies are so extraordinarily complicatedly intertwined. In such a way, for instance, the Rehab Care, which is one of the company which the HSE gives €50 million to, is guaranteed and is only still in existence according to the auditors because it is backed up and by Rehab itself, which pays her salary. So, you know, they affect each other in all sorts of different ways.
Did Angela Cairns not say that she said that the charity owns all the assets?
Yeah, she did say that.
And I mean, that struck me as another very good reason for saying, listen, the charity owns all the assets, so therefore even all this other stuff that you're saying is commercial and private would not be there were it not for the original charity. So there's a, it struck me at various times that there was a lot of illogicality in their argument. Yeah. And even this thing of, we won't reveal the salaries now, but we'll reveal them towards the end of the year. And this woman who worked for Rehab Care, where 98% of her salary is paid by the state, and yet it was still being stated that it couldn't be it couldn't be revealed. There were an awful lot of inconsistencies in that way.
But it can be revealed. I mean, yeah, it can be. All they had to do was say, yeah, here's what it is. And you know, they're saying, you know, the data protection. They said, oh, the data under the Data Protection Act, we can't reveal it. That anybody can waive their right to the Data Protection Act and say, look, that's it, it's over. But the people in front of us there wouldn't do it today. And yeah, they're playing games. They're playing games, but the motivation behind the whole game is, don't let anybody know. And you do have to ask, why is there such a absolute fear of people knowing what's going on? I mean, certainly 240,000 is an awful lot of money, and she's got a good reason for not being proud of being paid so much if she's running a charity. But you have to ask why they put up so much effort to resist these questions, and whether there's more in there that we would like to know about and they don't want to know about.
But I think the fundamental argument she was trying to make was that she was running a group of companies. Okay, one of those group of companies was in the not-for-profit, and other groups of companies were not. Okay, so again, you know, if that was legally challenged, I'd say she'd have very strong ground. So I'd be interested to hear the panel on that status of a statement, because really she's basically saying that, you know, she's not obliged under the status of the group to basically give this information. Now, I suppose, so how do we classify the group? And then if there's more money to go into the group, what part of the group is it going into?
I think the fact is that a lot of charities operate in a hybrid way. They carry on activities, some of which are grant-aided and some of which operate with earned revenues of various kinds. I mean, I could quote opera companies, for example. So we should get used to that, and we should also get used to hybrid funding sources, not just public, but also philanthropic and from other sources, as well as from individuals and the general public. I think if the assets of an organisation are held by an entity which is a charity, it must pass two tests. It must be run for public benefit, and it must fall into one or other of the charitable categories, meaning it must be either for the benefit of religion, for the relief of poverty, or for other purposes of benefit to the community. And those two tests, if they are met, then the organisation is a charity, and it is there to promote the public good. I'd just like to say that one of the things that we're all reaching for is ways that we can find something good out of all of this, you know, in the spirit of not wasting a good crisis. And I do think that anybody working in the sector will tell you that many organisations and many individuals, leaders in the sector, are galvanised by this to ask, you know, what can we do? And in fact, only this morning I was at a seminar in the Institute of Public Administration, and Tom Arnold, who's the former highly respected CEO of Concern, pointed out that Concern, which is now not just in Ireland but internationally respected as a leading international aid organisation, whose accounts win the prizes for the best prepared financial statements, he pointed out that Concern's own reputation for transparency and for disclosure arises from a scandal in that organisation about 20 years ago. So, you know, perhaps this is at last bringing a sector which many people would say has been hidden in plain view, 100,000 people working in it. We have known very little about this sector. And in fact, even to call it a sector is something of a misnomer, because the sector, the word sector, covers a spectrum from community-based organisations, which are almost 100% funded, in many cases 100% funded by the state on the one end, to organisations which are entirely voluntary, indeed many which don't even employ staff, on the other end. And to call that a single sector, when in fact it is so many subsectors often operating entirely divorced from one another. You asked, Alan, earlier, you know, how do boards come to a decision about how to peg the level of remuneration? And the answer is, a lot of the time, in the dark, because we don't have information. Unlike other sectors or unlike other countries, where transparency about senior remuneration in charities is the norm and is expected and is driven by all kinds of regulation and indeed voluntary standards, we're just not there yet. But I do think that in the spirit of not wasting the crisis, I think many people now can see, as they perhaps couldn't see so clearly before, that it's actually time we changed this.
Yeah, there is a very interesting development going to arise shortly when the charities regulator is put into place, and the Charities Act will be enacted, because a lot of the things that have emerged in recent months were not issues when that was in development. But now that charities regulator is going to have to give priority to some of the things that have emerged in most recent weeks and months.
And how would such a charities regulator take on rehab and the unwillingness that we saw today? I mean, how would the regulator have any impact there?
I would hope the regulator would not knee-jerk reaction here, and impose on the sector itself, on all charities, rules and regulations to the other extreme. And unfortunately, this is what happens in issues at times like this, where it goes from one extreme to the other. And if we do, for example, in the credit union sector in Ireland, where there were 400 credit unions, local community credit unions operating in this country, all with their own independent boards, and they were all volunteers, unpaid. And you're talking about nearly 5,000 people volunteering on these boards around the country. And what's happened now is the introduction last year of new credit union legislation that imposes requirements on those credit union 5,000 directors of credit unions, a level of compliance that is just mind-boggling, where they've got to sign individually an annual compliance statement at the end of each year that they're in compliance with 220 provisions that are listed under governance in the Credit Union Act. Now, that's a pendulum that's gone from one extreme totally to the other. Mm. And what impact is that going to have on these volunteers and these communities? Only time will tell. It would be wrong if that pendulum swung in that way in the charity sector, because one could, at the end of the day, do great damage to it. So the regulator needs to be extremely careful by not overreacting, as we do as well as commentators.
Well, certainly that is what is happening with rehab now, and the way it behaves in the future will dictate a lot of that, I think, in terms of the other. Patricia touched on this. The other charities must be looking askance at their behaviour, and that it looks like that behaviour is going to continue. You know, that there's no sense of a climb down from them. It's belligerence the whole way.
Shane, were you able to figure out why rehab pays corporation tax in Poland?
No, I presume. I don't know. That's a local issue, and right. I don't know why it is. And nobody actually asked a question particularly about that. We didn't. You see, there were so many things
we
wanted to approach today, and we didn't get to the bottom of an enormous number of them. Mm. And that's one of the ones. It was touched on just for a second, but no, we didn't get that at all. I'm afraid no.
And I mean, the other thing, just before you came in, we were talking about the salaries again. And, you know, at the end of today, people who donate to rehab, people who bought the scratch cards, people who fundraise and so on, they still don't know where those donations have gone.
No, that's right. I mean, Patricia was just talking about so many of these charities being hybrids. And, you know, the problem being, of course, that the commercial arm hides a lot of the stuff that the people who are paying money into the boxes are not getting the information on. And the fact of the matter is that there are kind of two constituencies out there which I look at, but they're both funders and they're fundraisers. One is the state, and the state surely is entitled to know exactly what's going on, where its money is going. But we do tend to forget, and I think it's because the PAC's kind of remit is in dispute. We do tend to forget those people who actually give the money, and they give rehab gets a lot of money from innocent, good people who like helping and want to do that, and very generous people, and they haven't a clue where that money's not an idea where it's going, and it's not explained to them.
And there's another good reason why the state should care about this, which is that it's losing value. In other words, if in big simple terms, this is a sector where 65% of the funding comes from government, the other 35% comes from other people, and that means that a lot of the time the state is getting 100% of value for 65% of the cost. Now, if that 65% is not to shrink, if that 35% is not to shrink, thereby costing the state more, then the state really needs to get its act in gear and find ways of driving through sticks and carrots, and I wouldn't neglect the carrot. I think the problem is, with respect to the deputy, that the PAC is the biggest of big sticks, and there are many other ways of driving compliance because it appeals to charity's sense of self-interest. And in the spirit of what Alan was saying, I think it's very important that the regulator recognises this, that regulation needs to be proportionate, and it also needs to incentivise charities so they understand why their self-interest is actually served by helping the public to understand better.
I think the other problem there is that this big stick, i.e. the PAC, which has done some very good work in recent times, it's kind of all come out of the blue. This agenda and this openness and transparency, because we know that the first Dáil question was tabled on this section 38, 39, like I think it was 15 or 16 years ago, if not 17. Mm-hmm. And that there's a report done by the HSE, which I think indicates that the HSE became more formally aware of it in 1998. And it was discussed by the board of the HSE a year ago. And that there are some more political reasons for why this information came out. So I think that it's not as if the matter would be simpler if the motivations behind it were purer as well, I think.
Shane?
I don't know whether Shane has any.
Yeah, I take that criticism absolutely on the chin. I'm sure you're right. I mean, the PAC certainly has suddenly discovered this. I think that's fair enough. It suddenly discovered the kind of charities industry and what's happened there. And
I think as a result even of the HSE handing you reports, you may not even have been expecting.
That's correct. I mean, the HSE tended to hand us a couple of things, and in particular, the CRC one was the one that broke it. Yeah, and you know, you only had to look at the CRC report, which nobody would normally be doing, to see if there was something extraordinary going on in there. A layman would have been able to tell you that. And then, yeah, it was to some extent an accident. I think you're right. And we just kind of, I actually stumbled across the CRC thing, and then it became apparent that this thing was not what you thought it was, and that charity wasn't being run the way we thought it was. And then, of course, you got into this business of finding out the chief executive paid out of charity money. And then, of course, public outrage became enormous, and rightly so. It exploded because people who were paying money, started realizing their money was not going where they wanted to. But sure, I think it's very healthy, I must say. I mean, I'm sure we've made lots of mistakes. And we've probably been unfair to some people, and I'm sorry if we have. But on the whole, I think it's very healthy that there is a body like the PAC to look into this extraordinarily protected and unregulated area.
Yeah, but I also think, Shane, the PAC should have revisited their own governance model.
Yeah,
it's not
because at the moment, sure. it's a roaring match, I think,
What do you mean, Niall?
Well, I just think it's if you're put in front of the PAC, that's fine. It's for accountability and transparency, and rightly so. But I think behaviour of some of that members in the PAC needs to be revisited, because certainly if one attends board meetings like I do, you try to be structured, focused, very clear up front what you're looking for, and very clear what your outcomes are. I think it's been used for political gain at the moment, like a political football, to be honest.
I think that's a bit unfair, actually. I think that you often get that in committees, and of course you'll get an element of it in the PAC because you have people from opposing parties and people in government and people in opposition. But I think largely the committee has pulled together pretty well. Even looking at the committee meeting this afternoon, you can see that there almost seems to be a level of unofficial cooperation going on between the various sides.
Yeah, there was surprising unity today. I mean, there have been political difficulties. That's no secret within the PAC. And there were particular political undertones about bringing in rehab, which you could probably understand, and about the CRC. But on the whole, those have been lost. And people, I mean, John McGuinness is the chairman of it, and he's Fianna Fáil. I should think he got a lot of stick for letting the CRC in, quite honestly, because it was embarrassing to Fianna Fáil. I think it's greatly to his credit that happened. So, yeah, sure, and there's grandstanding, and we are all aware of the fact the camera's there. You're absolutely right. We are aware of that.
There's a code of professional conduct.
But you can't expect politicians not to be aware of that. But on the whole, I think they've been trying to do what they, together, by the way, and there's very little tension about that. They've been trying together to get some accountability going. And I think it sometimes looks a little bit dramatic. I think that's probably fair enough. But that's in the nature of the confrontational questions that are coming. And when you've got some, you see, when you've got some bodies like the CRC and rehab there, it's not like a board meeting. It's not at all like a board meeting. It's not meant to be. You've got people there who are absolutely determined to frustrate you. That's what was happening. So it's not quite as cosy as you'd think. And there is a certain amount of adversarial conversation going on by virtue of the fact that you've got absolutely opposite objectives.
I think the other thing that's interesting is it's lifting the lid on a set of sort of hermetic relationships. I mean, the HSE has known a great deal about all of these organisations because it's their business too. It's not true that these organisations are unregulated. I mean, if you look at I've done some work on risk with some healthcare charities, the number of regulations that they have to comply with would make your eyes water. And the compliance environment that is imposed on them by the service contracts they have with the HSE is really, really onerous. So I think it's a manifestation of the problem that, you know, years later, and all these debates having been raging now for several months, we're still calling $2.5 billion worth of expenditure Section 38. Hands up anybody who knows what Section 38 means. I mean, why don't we call it services that the state has undertaken to deliver to its citizens and which it has subcontracted? Why don't they find some other way that explains that? Because it's an awful lot of money. And I think it's a manifestation of the problem of this closed circuit accountability. So there is a very highly specialised form of accountability between the funder and its grantees, but they're acting as though they're not in a glass bowl. And to me, the problem is that accountability, this highly specialised form of accountability has been developed with no transparency. And so, I think sometimes the two words are used as though they're synonyms and they're not.
And Alan, do you agree with that? That while the executives from rehab, I don't know how they're feeling tonight, they may have been happy with their performance today, I don't know, but confidence in their organisation is hugely dented.
Yes, I'd say, I think they employ 3,500 people, good people as well. They're doing wonderful work. And the dent to their confidence must be very damaging. So I think the executive need to look internally within the organisation see how they can limit the damage that has been done to their internal morale, as well as looking outside to public opinion that has most certainly been dented.
Niall, do you think in any way is Angela Cairns worth €240,000? I mean, is it possible for you to say or to make that assessment?
Well, I suppose to answer that question, you have to go back to, I suppose, the scope of what the job she got day one. From a HR point of view, I'm sure at board level and remuneration committee have set out their KPIs for the role. I'm sure they have aligned that to their business strategy. I'm sure she's very clear how she's measured and she has to be accountable, I presume, on a monthly basis or whatever the structure of the company is. So I suppose what's not clear is that how are you really judging her salary? Are you judging her salary under the umbrella of not-for-profit? So if you are, she's very well paid. Are you judging her salary with 60% of it in the private sector, which would mean she's also well paid? Okay, so the balance on the seesaw argument for me, from a HR point of view, would be, you know, she has got the structure and the remuneration package that she applied for. Okay, and I think, to be fair, the PAC have a role to try get the next phase of this debate, which is very clearly to get what is the structure behind this salary, what is the terms of reference behind this, and more importantly, I think, to be fair to the CEO, to balance her argument as well, because really she's picking up a role. Like in the private sector, let's take another example. You know, we've a couple of roles at the moment at CEO level that we're filling for companies, and you know, you put through the professional process and you put out your pack and you hire the person and you do it professionally. You know, I think what the PAC are basically looking for is a very clear trawl back through the process. How do we end up with this figure? And I think if this was handled, honestly, from a HR point of view, not alone a PR point of view, differently, and if the defence wasn't so big, I think this would have been dealt with very fast. But I think because the worst thing you say when you go to any debate or any PAC forum is no, because it automatically, it doesn't lend itself to good negotiation.
Do you agree, Shane?
Well, no, I don't. I can't see how you can justify paying someone 240,000 in a sector which, whatever reports they've got, compares with an average here. I think Mary Lou McDonald got it out today of somewhere between 59 and 70,000 for a charity.
It's actually a lot higher. Well, if you go through the top 10, it's a lot higher.
Well, that's the top 10, maybe, but we're talking about the average.
Well, if you go tier two, you know, and tier three, well, I just share the data, which they're all.
I've seen that figures down at 59,000, and they were reputable. So if you go through the top 10, of course the average is going to be higher. But why do you go through the top 10 unless you want to come out with the result like that? I think that's absurd. Of course you get a higher result if you go through the top 10. I agree with you about one thing, and that is, I think that the. Those who set this salary should answer for it. And I think they should have come in, and they didn't come in. And Angela Cairns, rather disingenuously and unconvincingly, when she was asked about it, she said, you should be asking the Remuneration Committee in. That's what she said. And she was the person who was asked to bring them in and didn't bring them in. So there's a lot of funny things going on there which are not helpful to the transparency which we need, getting the information that we need. And she's not helping it either. So she's obviously complicit in that. And she could have pushed them to do it.
So who would be in charge of, would it be Angela Cairns or the board who would tell the Remuneration Committee, if we're all having trouble with it now, to, you know, under proper corporate governance?
Well, the board would be in charge completely. And she would, there would be a Remuneration Committee which would recommend to the board what her salary was.
Terms of directing that group to come into the PAC.
Well, what happened there, technically speaking, what happened there, I gather, I'm pretty sure, is the clerk of the committee got in touch with her, she's chief executive, and said that we wanted her to come in, we wanted the remuneration to come in, we wanted the last chief executive, Frank Lannery, to come in, and we wanted the chairman to come in. There's a bit of dispute about the chairman, but never mind. And I presume it was conveyed to them that they were invited to come in to help out on this issue. And they decided, and this is where the extraordinary arrogance comes in, I think, they decided, no, they weren't going to send in those people. And you're asking who they is. Yeah. Well, it ought to be the board, of course. It ought to be the board. But there are an awful lot of boards, as we all know, which are dominated by their chief executive. I don't know whether this is one of those boards or not, but I suspect that she has a huge and large say over what happens, in fact, at board level. But I don't know that for a fact. But that's my guess, because there are reluctance to actually come up front.
Patricia, did you want to come in there?
Well, I suppose my point, if I were one of the 55,000 people who serves on the board of non-profits in Ireland, or if I were one of the 100,000 people who works, this is a standing army of people we're talking about here. What are the takeouts from all of this? I would have thought that disclosure has to be the first item on the agenda of the next board meeting. And what does disclosure mean? It's not mysterious. There is a standard of financial reporting for charities. There is a governance standard for charities. There are fundraising standards for charities. This is the core business of charities, to be well run in the public interest and to tell the public what they're doing with their money. One aspect of telling the public what you do with their money is saying, what do we spend on our administration? And as a dimension of that, what are we spending on salary costs? And there are perfectly well understood, well tested standards for doing this, which are, you know, which anybody can put their hands on. And the point is, people should start doing it now, before they're made to do it, because once charity regulation is in place, surely, step by step, the environment will change. The leading charities are there already, and that's why they're leading, and that's why they're still there. The durable organisations that do the best work have seen the light already.
And just finally, Shane, is that it as far as rehab in front of the PAC is concerned? Will they be back?
I think they may well be, because they were left with a lot of unanswered questions. Some of which they promised to come back on, but I wouldn't be too confident that there'd be very full and frank replies, to be quite honest, from what we got today. We were promised that we'd get answers on pensions, on further matters of disclosures of relative, what's it called? I've forgotten the phrase, but where there are companies where there's a kind of connected party having a contract with them, that we're going to come back on that. I suspect that we will be looking for them, if we don't get that information, to come back when we're looking for the board as well.
Okay, thank you all very much indeed. Late Debate back on Tuesday at 10. Till then, have a lovely weekend.